Drive Time on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Zurich. When it comes to mortgage protection, trust Zurich. Get the advice you need from a financial broker today.
Tweet at Drive Time RTE.
You're welcome back. Russia's war in Ukraine, which began on the 24th of February, is now in its 100th day. So far, Russian forces are in control of 20% of Ukrainian territory. Fighting is continuing in the eastern city of Severodonetsk, which is now largely under Russian control. Joining me on the line now is international correspondent with the London Independent, Belle True. Belle, you're very welcome to the programme. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. There's an awful lot of analysis of what the impact of the last 100 days of war is in Ukraine. What is your opinion?
Well, obviously, we've seen this focus on the east and the south of the country. And as you said, 20% of Ukraine is now sort of under Russian control. They've largely given up the idea of marching on Kyiv. But from what I've been looking at and people I've been speaking to, one of the more sort of insidious impacts of the last 100 days has been an attempt to not only take territory from Ukraine, but to turn that into Russian territory. So what's known as a kind of Russification of these areas. So speaking to people who fled occupied towns like Berdansk or Melitopol, they've told me that there's a concerted effort by the Russian occupying forces to have an impact on those towns, whether it's trying to control the curriculum, speaking Ukrainian, the language, hard, and making Russian language basically the language that is spoken, and also in terms of actually getting people to have Russian passports.
And this is coercive, isn't it? It's not simply encouraged or an option.
Yeah, so it's difficult to say exactly what's going on, because obviously I'm not in those occupied towns. And I will say that a lot of the east and south of Ukraine are naturally Russian-speaking areas. They're sort of Russophone, there's a sort of deep Russian-affiliated history there. But at the same time, speaking to people who fled those areas, it's very clear that there's an attempt to erase the Ukrainian identity. And this is coming through the medium of either making it easier to get a Russian passport, or at least talking to the mayor of one of the cities, Melitopol, who told me it's apparently now mandatory to have a Russian passport in those towns, or whether it's, for example, actually forcibly taking people to Russia. Again, I can't say exactly what's going on because I'm not in the towns. This is what's been told to me by people who fled those towns or by Ukrainian officials. Russia, of course, denies this completely and says that they are just trying to help Russian-speaking citizens who are under attack.
Talk to me a little bit more about people who are disappeared that you mentioned there. These are people who, once the Russian army comes into town, if there are people who demonstrate or oppose the Russian soldiers, they're taken away somewhere and not heard of again. Is that right?
Yeah, so there's obviously, we don't have an exact number of how many people have disappeared. I mean, certainly when I was traveling around areas that were formerly occupied by Russian forces, like the Kyiv regions and also the Sumy regions, so that's places like Trostianets, there are people who are missing, who were taken by Russian soldiers and have vanished. We don't know how many of those in total, what's happened to them. When I was speaking to the mayor of Melitopol, like I said, which is a coastal town that's under Russian occupation, he said 500 people had been kidnapped, but he didn't know if they were still in the town or whether they'd been taken to Russia. So there's a disclaimer to what I'm saying is we don't know what's going on. And of course, Russia vehemently denies this. But what we understand is that people are being at least coerced or forcibly taken to Russia from Ukraine. The Ukrainian officials say at least 1.5 million people have been taken to Russia, and they say illegally transferred, so basically coerced. The Russians deny that vehemently. They said that they've evacuated people for their own safety, and that's included taking people to Russia because the bombardment from the Ukrainian side is so high. So what we're looking at here is basically a big mess with lots of missing people, with an unknown number of people who've gone to Russia and unknown reasons for going there. Did they go there voluntarily, or were they given an impossible choice, or were they kidnapped and taken?
What's your estimation, Belle, as to whether there's an end in sight or not 100 days into the war? It was quite certain at the very start that certainly the Kremlin didn't see it going on for this long. But are we in now for a long, protracted war in the east of Ukraine? Or is there any negotiated or compromise, negotiated settlement or compromise that can be seen somewhere in the distance?
The problem is trying to work out what a negotiation or what a sort of win for both sides would look like. For Russia, they have lost a lot. There is massive sanctions that are now being placed on them worldwide. you know, Putin obviously, he at least intended to march on Kyiv and probably force a regime change. He's had to give up on those. He has to give up on those aspirations and is focused on the east and the south. They've encountered massive losses. Their army has not performed very, very well. They've lost probably millions or billions of dollars worth of equipment in the field. So for them, you know, the stakes are high, and they've been basically severed from the rest of the world in terms of massive sanctions. So he's got to show his people back at home what they've managed to get out of this extremely expensive war. For the Ukrainians, they cannot afford to lose a single inch of land. They already lost Crimea years and years ago in an illegal annexation from the Russian side. And they had, you know, swathes of Ukraine that was basically run by pro-Russian separatists. And what happened is that became a foothold from which Russia was able to, you know, launch the invasion that took place first on February 24th. So for them, if they were to lose parts, if they were to give up parts of Donbass, if they were to give up the southern coast, parts of the southern coast, that could be a staging ground in the future for another war to happen. And also, you know, economically, they can't allow it to happen. Mm-hmm. We're already looking at the total closure of exports of grain from Ukraine, for example. It's the fifth largest exporter of wheat in the world because of the coast basically being controlled pretty much by Russia. If they were to give up those cities completely, that's a massive economic impact on them. So the problem is what does a settlement look like? What could allow both sides to back down? And, you know, and what would allow Russia to basically stop the war? And yeah. I just can't see that happening anytime soon.
Well, that is a sad fact. 100 days in, we don't know for how long more it will go on. Bel Tru, international correspondent with the London Independent, thank you very much indeed for joining us. Now, it's 100 days since the invasion of Ukraine by Russia, and the conflict, as we heard earlier in the programme, has moved east to the Donbass region. The fighting has been referred to as fierce. One commander from the Ukrainian army on that front has described it as hell, with Russia declaring today that they'll continue fighting until all goals have been achieved. I'm joined now by Professor Angela Stent, who is the director of the Center for Eurasian, Russian and East European Studies at Georgetown University. She's also the author of Putin's World, Russia Against the West and the Rest. Professor Stent, you're very welcome to the programme, and thank you very much indeed on this day that marks 100 days of war in Ukraine. I'm watching reports of President Zelensky of Ukraine declaring on social media to his people today that victory will be ours at the 100-day mark, but that remains unclear today, doesn't it?
It certainly does. I mean, I think he's still trying to raise morale. The Ukrainians have been very challenged in the last couple of weeks. The Russians have made gains in the Donbass, as your reporters were saying before. And I think until the latest American and other NATO equipment arrives for the Ukrainians, it's going to be very difficult for them to continue pushing the Russians back. And he himself admitted that the Russians do control a fifth of the territory now of Ukraine.
Yeah, and $700 million worth of military equipment promised by President Biden yesterday, isn't that right? But no long-range missiles or weaponry that could attack Russia from Ukraine. What about reports that Vladimir Putin is ill and that is affecting his commandership of the strategy of the war? Is there any evidence of that?
Well, these rumors have been around since the beginning of the war. It depends what sources you read. I think, you know, none of us really know whether he's ill or not. We do know that he was isolated, very isolated, for 2.5 years during the COVID pandemic, and only surrounded by a few people who were reinforcing all the views he had about how Ukraine wasn't a country. So I think you can't dismiss those reports that he was ill. He certainly didn't look very robust during the May the 9th Victory Day parade celebrations, but we'll just have to see.
As author of Putin's World, Russia Against the West and the Rest, how do you decipher what he means, Vladimir Putin, when he says that fighting will continue until all goals have been achieved? What does he mean by that?
Well, I think what he means, that keeps changing. I think in the beginning they wanted to subdue and take over the whole of Ukraine. I think right now they're focused on taking all of the Donbass, so the part that they occupied before the war began, and now the rest of it. And then we'll see, will that be enough for them, or will they try and go back to trying to take Kyiv again, or maybe Odessa, the largest port? So we don't know what those goals are, and they keep shifting. It used to be quote-unquote, denazifying and demilitarizing Ukraine. Mm-hmm. Well, they can always say they've done that and announce victory, but that could change too.
But the international response, if they did try and go back and recapture or capture Kyiv, would be as intense as before, wouldn't it?
Oh, of course it would be, but we've already imposed very tough sanctions on Russia. There would probably be more to impose. Yes, I think it would be a very strong response. But as we know so far, certainly the U.S. has said there will not be U.S. troops in Ukraine, so that the international response would not go as far as doing anything that might provoke an actual conflict between Russia and the United States.
You mentioned the sanctions. We just this week had a sixth round of sanctions, talk already of a seventh round of sanctions that could be negotiated, particularly around Russian oil this time from the European Union. Is it having the desired effect, I wonder?
I think we haven't seen that so far. I think when the EU oil ban goes into full effect, and we know it doesn't affect pipeline gas, of course that takes billions of dollars from the Russian coffers that can fuel the war. But at the moment, Putin, I think, seems to have discounted the impact of the sanctions. I think when they're really going to hit us, as Russia, you know, runs out of components to make its weapons and its military equipment function properly with all the export controls we have now from the West. But so far, that does not seem to have changed his political decision-making.
Mm-hmm. What will influence Vladimir Putin to change course here or to stop the war? On the international stage, China is probably the biggest acquiescer, if I can use that word, make up a word perhaps. Could China be influenced to have a negating influence on Vladimir Putin and the Kremlin to change course here and stop the war?
Well, so far, all attempts to try and get China to put some pressure on Russia have failed. The Chinese have adamantly said that they will not do that, even though I think they don't like the scale of the violence they see. And they're certainly being very careful not to go around Western sanctions. But the Chinese, I think, do not want to get involved in putting that kind of pressure on Russia.
Why not?
No,
why not,
other
Professor
Sent,
I wonder.
Could do them.
Because it seems immoral.
because you know, they are invested in this relationship with Russia to sort of push back against what they see as an illegal, if you like, Western imposed order on them. They want to push back against the United States, against other countries, particularly that criticize them for what they're doing domestically. And Russia is their ally in this. And therefore, it's a delicate balance for them, and they're not willing to push the Russians.
Is there any risk then for China that the rest of the international community in the West will say, well, if you don't help us here, we could turn on you and offer sanctions?
Well, but you have to look around the rest of the world, India, all of the BRICS countries, and much of Africa and the Middle East and Latin America. None of them have condemned Russia. None of them have sanctioned Russia. They sort of want to stay out of this and they all have different reasons for doing it. So I don't think there's no other country that could persuade the Chinese to do more to dissuade the Russians from what they're doing. You really have the West against the rest here, and the rest doesn't really want to get involved in.
Yeah, which is incredible to many people looking on in countries in the West. So how will this war end then?
I don't think anyone knows that. It could go on for weeks, months. Eventually, there might be a ceasefire. There might be an agreement to have territorial compromises. But I think as long as Putin is in power, or people, even if he weren't in power, people who share his views, the Russians aren't going to give up on trying to take back Ukraine and form this kind of Slavic union of Belarus, Ukraine, and Russia. Sort of recreating part of the Russian Empire because they seem so hell-bent on doing that now.
Can I ask you a question that's probably impossible to answer? But is Putin's position as leader of Russia, has it been damaged in any way or undermined by his obvious weak strategy in this war?
Well, if you look at the public opinion data from the one independent pollster in Russia, a vast majority of the Russians support him and support the war because he has framed it in terms of this is like World War II. We defeated the Nazis in 1945, and now we're defeating the Nazis in Ukraine in 2022. So public opinion is still with him. Are there people around him or in other parts of officialdom that don't like what's happening? I'm sure that there are. But his position at the moment seems to be very firm. I know there are rumors that came out in the last couple of days that there was an assassination attempt against him in March. Again, we don't know any of the details of that. We don't know how true that is. So he seems to still be in pretty firm command and is protected by those people around him who want to keep him in power.
And on the Ukraine side, finally, they want EU membership. They want that process to be expedited. And then all the while, people on the international stage, diplomats, are wondering, how will we bring an end to this war? Now, a former senior-ranking US official and diplomat, Henry Kissinger, suggested that Ukraine should cede part of its country to Russia, particularly in the east. That caused huge anger and a backlash. But I wonder, could he be right when it all falls, when the cards all fall finally?
Well, the problem is that what Mr. Kissinger was advocating was going back to the status quo on February the 23rd, when Russia occupied part of the Donbas and Crimea. Well, but then that wasn't enough for Russia, and so they invaded the country. So there's no telling, there's no guarantee that if Ukraine were to say, all right, let's go back to the status quo ante, which is what Mr. Kissinger suggested, that they wouldn't then be at war with Russia again 6 months or a year later. Given Russia's track record in dealings with Ukraine and other of its neighbors, there's absolutely no reason to believe that they would abide by any of these negotiated settlements. So you'd need much stronger guarantees to make sure that that would work.
Well, it seems from your analysis that there's nothing but uncertainty on the horizon. Look, we'll leave it there for the moment. Thank you very much indeed for talking to us. Professor Angela Stent, Director of the Centre for Eurasian, Russian and East European Studies at Georgetown University.